Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Epicenter podcast. Today, we have a very special guest with us. Today, we have Chris Boss, who is the founder of LAVA, which is the Laboratory for Visionary Architecture. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Technology in Sydney and was a key designer of the Beijing Water Cube. He is a recipient of the Emerging Architect Ariba Award and Perspectives 40 Under 40 for Asia's Rising Design Stars. His work combines digital workflow, nature's principles, and the latest digital fabrication technologies to achieve more with less. More architecture with less material, energy, time, and cost. He designs everything from sustainable master plans to eco offices and apartment towers, stadiums, and instant installations. LAVA has won the international competition for the Zero Carbon City Center of Masdar UAE and the UN Zero Prize for reskinning an aging icon tower. So with that, Chris, welcome to the Epicenter.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Welcome, Chris. Welcome. We are very excited to have you. I would like to start with, what does LAVA mean for you? What is LAVA? Can you describe it for our audience, and can you describe your design philosophy?
Well, that's quite a few questions in one. I mean, firstly, the name LAVA. So we started our architecture practice in 2007. And we always thought it's more than an architecture practice. It's a network of like-minded individuals. And we didn't want to name it after our names, like Chris Boss Architects or Tobias Walliser Alexander Rieck Architects. So we were looking for a name that was more inclusive and is open to interpretation, but acts as an umbrella in order to bring other people on board under this umbrella. So there could be LAVA design, LAVA interior, LAVA architecture, LAVA products, LAVA master planning, LAVA fashion, and everybody can kind of identify with that brand. So it's more brand than you know, our individual names. And there's a proud tradition of these acronyms in architecture, I think starting from people like Rem Koolhaas with OMA, the Office for Metropolitan Architecture, and BIG, and SOM, and KPF, and so on. Often these acronyms stand for names, like Cohen, Patterson, Fox, KPF, but then increasingly they became kind of a play on words. And for us, LAVA had to do with laboratory, with vision, and with architecture. And laboratory, because we think that architecture is not a predefined formula. It's something that you need to discover and experiment, and that is open for interpretation and experimentation. Visionary, because we don't think that architecture can just simply build on what existed before. You know, obviously the history of architecture is important, but even the history of architecture is full of vision. You know, the vision of the world 2,000 years ago, 500 years ago, 20 years ago. And as we know, the world changes continuously. Nobody could have expected the world to be the way that it is in 2020. So we like to project forward for the next 10 years, 20 years, 100 years, and 1,000 years, how we see the world unfolding. And that's where the vision comes in. In the beginning, people were a little bit hesitant to embrace this idea of vision. So our concern was a little bit developers. The last thing they want is a laboratory where they don't know what the outcome is. The last thing they need is a vision where they have to kind of think ahead. But I think more and more people realize that a vision for the future is needed. And lastly, LAVA obviously also is the name of a fluid rock material that erupts from volcanoes. So we thought there's a nice dynamic about this idea of eruption and constant flow and metamorphosis and not standing still.
That makes sense.
We have our junior team, which is kind of the up and coming LAVA members. We call them magma in the tradition of geoscience. So magma is kind of the LAVA before it erupts. And there are students from universities around the world that do internships within our offices and then grow into full-blown LAVA members over time.
I love that, the wordplay. I very much appreciate that. I want to reiterate kind of the last part of Max's question there. And I realize this is an open-ended question, so please take all the time you need. But can you describe for us, perhaps at a high level, what your design philosophy is or what your kind of architectural philosophy is? What drives your work?
So there's a number of different angles to that question. I think what you mentioned in the introduction was this idea of more with less. And more with less, again, is this play on words where Mies van der Rohe famously said, less is more. So you have to do as little as possible as an intervention. I think Philip Johnson said, less is more. And Rem Koolhaas said all sorts of things. So it is a kind of an ongoing philosophical debate amongst architects. And I think Buckminster Fuller actually coined this terminology of more with less. And so more means for us, we don't want to, in this age of sustainability and being mindful of resources and all these kind of social economic issues, we don't want to stop doing what we're doing. So we want to produce more architecture, we want to develop more communities, we want to help more people, we want to create more cities, but we have to do it increasingly with less energy, less materials, and essentially less, more technology and less natural resources. And that leads to this idea of more with less. That could mean that we build a tower with the least amount of materials, with the least amount of embedded energy, but with the most amount of spatial diversity and offering to the people. So that is one of the aspects. Another important aspect of our architecture is this research in nature and combining these ideas from nature and technology to form contemporary architecture. So when you look at nature as a precedent, and architects have always looked at nature for thousands of years, you know, since the pyramids, then nature has all these principles that have evolved over millions of years, and nature is kind of perfect. So the principles of nature are always valid and optimized. When you think about, you know, the sun, the moon, the stars, about how trees grow, about how rivers flow, how flowers blossom, etc., etc. When you look at things like coral reefs, you know, ecosystems where millions of different species thrive together in an ecosystem and mutually respecting each other and delivering nutrients and energy to each other and grow together. And on the other hand, technology is this thing that has also always been around us. You know, if you define technology, you know, as the person in the cave kind of starting the first fire, that was a technological breakthrough or the invention of the wheel. But the technology changes increasingly more and more rapidly. And that was always the case over the last 2000 years, but even in the last 10 years or so, when you think about communication technology, when you think about our phones that are now incredible computers, if you just think about how we now talk to each other with virtual backgrounds and over the internet and different time zones, the way that we travel, the way that we work, the way that the whole society works. It's a constant change in technology. And so we think that if you combine these ancient and everlasting, always valid principles of nature with these constantly, rapidly changing new technologies, and you combine them into something new, into like a hybrid between nature and technology, then you have a chance at building contemporary architecture that is always contemporary. So you refer to the past, you refer to the present, you refer to the future, but you always combine natural principles with the latest technologies. It sounds very complicated, but it makes a lot of sense when you think about 200 years ago, architecture would have been the latest craftsmanship, the latest materials, the latest knowledge available applied to the architecture at the time 200 years ago. And so we are doing the exact same thing now, only that the world has become incredibly complex over the last 20 years or so.
Well, speaking of that kind of complexity and the interplay between nature and technology as it relates to architectural design, how do kind of computational design and the algorithmic design methodologies that are now kind of popular in architecture, how do those play into your work at Lava, and how do you kind of integrate those sort of cutting edge technologies with this focus on kind of biomimicry?
So the idea of parametric architecture, it sounds very, very complicated and highly technological and highly philosophical. But I like to explain it this way. Essentially, in any architectural design process, there's a lot of different parameters influencing your design decisions. So let's say if you build a house, then you have a space program, you want four bedrooms, you want a garage, you have criteria like you want a concrete floor, you want southern light or northern light, you want a terracotta roof, you want a chimney, you want, I don't know, a certain type of fit out. But there's endless variations on all of this. So how do you make the decisions? Then you have a site, you have a solar path, you have a breeze, you have local conditions like traffic, I don't know, planes flying over, proximities to other, to shopping or to other amenities. You have electricity, you have water, you have all these different things. And traditionally, the architect takes all these parameters and combines them in his mind into a perfect outcome. So that's the house. So a very simple example. And for a house, that is probably quite possible that a single architect deals with all these parameters and all the different people involved in the process and turns that into a house. If you build an airport or a multimodal transportation interchange, say in Hong Kong, then you have infinitely more parameters, infinitely more people involved, and infinitely more factors that need to lead to your design decision. And in parametric architecture, we program these different influences and set them within a relational network. And we weigh them. So one thing may be more important than another thing, and that may change during the course of the project. But that gives you, through computational means, a transparency of a highly complex situation. So all of a sudden you can judge the balance between the most amount of daylight you want in this project versus the solar entry that you want to avoid because of overheating, the wind load that you need for natural ventilation versus getting a drafty interior that becomes uncomfortable, or in the case of a train station where you have a complex traffic network, which is usually multi-layered. They're all different factors. And so we try to program all these factors into a computational environment and then have possible outcomes where the architect can then make a much more informed decision rather than a formal decision. So you may say, I want this to be round or square or red or blue or green, which is fine. But now when you have this parametric setup in front of you, you can make decisions based on performative criteria. So what is the possible best project in this cultural context, in this geographical context, in this technological context, in this financial realm? What is the best possible outcome for the client and for the public and for everybody else? I hope that wasn't too complicated as an explanation. So what I'm saying is the world has become increasingly more complex, and computers help us maintain the transparency in the decision-making process. And therefore, the outcome of our projects is much more complex as it would be in the past. You know, when you look at the pyramids as a as an example from 2,000 years ago, the pyramids are an extremely simple, archaic, you know, structure. A pyramid on a square, built from one single material, and housing only one single room, which is the grave of the pharaoh. So it's extremely simple, but extremely sophisticated, and that works for a simple brief like that. But as soon as the brief becomes more complex, which it now is, you need to take into consideration all these other parameters.
What is your favorite design that you have done with Lava? Your favorite project?
My favorite design. That is very difficult to choose between your many children. You know, there's some designs are. I'm always asked this question about success, right? So it depends how you define success. So what's the most successful project? Is it the one that wins the most awards? Is it the one that makes most profit? Is it the one that makes most people happy, you know? And one of the projects that is very close to my heart is this creative writing center for children in Redfern, Sydney, which is essentially a kind of an after-school program where kids go in the afternoon, learn about writing, about creativity, about drawing, about poetry, about writing songs, and so on. And the brief was essentially to create an environment that doesn't look like a school. It looks more like a fantasy environment. So it kind of, as soon as you enter the space, you become part of this fantasy world. And we kind of interpreted this as this Martian embassy, which is kind of like the inside of a whale. So it looks like out of this world. And even during construction, when one day the builder brought his children along to the construction site, they went completely nuts just seeing the space. And we kind of realized that it works, that they come in and they go, wow, I want to be here. What is this? Tell me. And they start creating even without being told. And I think that is really the key to motivation in an educational environment. You know, when you think about a school where you have like a classroom that is a square box and the teacher standing at the front and the children kind of listening, that's the old paradigm of teaching, you know, the transfer of knowledge from one person to the next generation. But the education of the future or contemporary education is about creating an environment where people can learn from each other and off each other, and storytelling, and the information is everywhere anyway, and that becomes more and more apparent now through the internet. It's not just retaining information in your head is not a skill in itself. It's about connecting information and working with information to create new things. So seeing these children in this creative writing center for me is the most satisfying project.
Yeah, I especially like the idea of how you're describing the architecture of the room and the architecture of the space can influence positively or negatively the behavior of the children they're in. We kind of take this for granted that the spaces we're in influence our actions there, but I love kind of putting it into action to influence the education of children specifically. And speaking of education, Chris, I studied economics in school and even continuing now in my work with Prospera. And I've always been fascinated by the concept of emergent order, which is the idea of something complex springing up from simple and decentralized actors, not guided by any kind of central plan or coordinator, and yet still resulting in the creation of something that is much more complex in a spontaneous way. So how does that kind of emergent order or spontaneous order play into your architectural designs and your architectural philosophy?
That's an interesting thought that you think about that in the financial world as well. But essentially, the way that we were taught architecture in the past is that the architect knows everything, and he is going to draw the perfect result. That's it, you know, and it may be a pyramid, or it may be a square, a cube, a circle, or a dome, or whatever. You know, it's like the God-given architect. And this idea of emergence plays into this idea of nature and technology and parameters, where you essentially lay out the basics and then let the basics, the different forces play with each other to have an outcome that is more than what you could have expected or anybody else could have expected. So it's this evolutionary growth process, which I also refer to in things like the coral reef or the rainforest. So the coral reef is based on rules that continuously adapt and adjust, and it grows according to these rules. But the result is unpredictable, but it's of unpredictable beauty. Like, I've never seen an ugly coral reef. And so it's always a perfect environment for the players within the coral reef, which is kind of an millions of different species with different roles and responsibilities. And in a way, we like to create architecture that plays out in front of us as well. When we start an architectural project, we don't come in with a predetermined idea, like this should be a black square glass tower. But we think about the millions of possibilities and then we let them unfold in front of us and kind of narrow them down. And it may end up a black square glass tower, but only if that's the most perfect solution for the task. But tell me about the financial modeling a little bit. That sounds interesting.
So it's almost more of a kind of philosophical concept in economics. It's focused more on the theory side than it is like specific modeling of specific financial actors. But you see this often emerge with like these kind of spontaneous rule sets. My favorite example of this is actually not from specifically economics, although the concept comes from my favorite economist, Friedrich Hayek. I'll give you two examples, one from economics and one not. In economics, the entirety of the distribution of the production of a given good is a form of emergent order. There's no centralized person in the government or in some bureaucratic office somewhere that says, you must create these pencils with this design in this way. Instead, there is a kind of an entrepreneur recognizes an inherent demand for pencils. He marshals the resources from various suppliers and firms and individuals to bring them together in a production process that can make these pencils in a affordable, profitable way. And then the price mechanism, which is kind of a knowledge discovery mechanism almost, then determines kind of how many of these pencils to make, because if the price is very high, then of course it's going to be profitable, which incentivizes the creation of more of them. If the price is lower and the margins are lower, then there's going to be less of them because there's a less of a profit opportunity there. But the entire concept, the entire activity of creating and distributing and selling pencils emerged spontaneously by a ton of individual voluntary actors working in concert with one another without any centralized edict telling them how to do it. So it's kind of a concept that's pervasive in economics. But my favorite example of it is actually language. English language specifically, but all languages except with the sole exception of French, are a completely emergent phenomenon. No one on high, no king commanded, this is how the English language is going to be spoken. This is specifically what every word is going to mean. I mean, even today in the last week or so, there's been definition changes for words that have been around for centuries because the context and the meaning changes, but there's no centralized board or council that's saying, hey, this word now means this thing instead of this other thing. It's this concept of individuals working without working toward a specific goal, creating a much more complex and kind of emergent and beautiful. It's this concept of beautiful anarchy almost, for lack of a better term. And it usually creates things that, in my opinion, at least, are often more beautiful than the kind of centrally designed outputs, precisely because of that anarchic emergent nature of it.
Yeah. I mean, good example is probably also social media. You know, when you think about something like TikTok that didn't even exist 6 months ago and is now, I think, one of the largest companies on the planet, and the amount of content being created every second, you know, outstrips all our combined lifetimes together. and it's incredible content, right? And it's not Steven Spielberg. It's some kid at home who comes up with some stupid idea of a cat with a wig on, I don't know, sitting on, I don't know, on a kitchen desk, and it creates content. And so these kind of trends, and it's similar to language, isn't it? Like, it's things that kind of emerge and nobody would have thought of, and nobody would have thought that's funny or interesting. Nobody certainly would have thought that it's worth $1 billion, but it is. And other traditional economies, you know, digging up iron ore is kind of interesting as well, but it's very quantifiable and it doesn't have anywhere to go, you know? It's like finite.
That's beautiful. I love it. Chris, returning and talking about this intangible world, about this idea world, what do you think? How architecture can evolve and do that next step of bringing an idea and converting to reality? How you can make sure that your buildings and your ideas can be tangibles?
How can I make sure that my buildings are tangible?
Yeah, like buildables, in other words. How you can make an impossible idea possible?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting difficult question as well. How do you make an impossible idea possible? I think you have to start with dreaming, right? So you have to wake up in the morning and say, today we're going to do the impossible. Because if you just do the possible, then you're not going to go anywhere with it. You know, it's like you have to dare to think outside the parameters. And that's where why it's actually important in an architecture studio to create this environment where these ideas can emerge, which is similar to what we were just talking about, emerging kind of markets and content. Because if you only go from what you know, and that's a big danger, you know, the big three-letter companies that I mentioned earlier sitting in New York and Chicago, they have a lot of knowledge and they've been doing it for 100 years, but they will never come up with anything other than what they've been doing for 100 years. But if you create an environment where, like, I don't know, the window cleaner walks in and says, hey, that looks cool, why don't we turn that upside down? And it's much better than it was before. So we need to create these environments where this can happen. And sometimes that is kind of seen as like amateurish or informal, or I don't know. But you need to allow the next generation and other disciplines to inform your work. And of course, you as a head of a practice, you're responsible for it, and it has to work, and you have to lay it to the client, it has to be in time and budget and buildable and all of that. But if you don't allow other ideas to come in, then you will not develop. And of course, there's always resistance, you know, like if a developer says we want 400 apartments in a particular lot, it has to be cost efficient, has to be finished in 12 months, and the apartments have to sell for maximum price, then they revert to formulas of what people generally want, how big apartments generally are, what they generally cost, and usually also use architects that are creating this average outcome. And then you have this average apartment tower of 400 apartments. Yes, it will sell, it will be okay, but it won't be the future of architecture and urbanism. And it's interesting that now we live in a time where we actually need to think about new models for those sort of things. You know, if all of a sudden people work from home, then you can't put them into like 9 square meter bedrooms anymore because they need space to work and to move. They need light and air, and they need to have ability to be separate, but also ability to be together. And even more so in work environments. So for the last 20, 30 years, the work environment was all about the shared office and the co-working and everybody, you know, no more office cubicles and no more separation. And now with the current COVID situation, all of a sudden, all that has to be rethought again. And I mean, the traditional office doesn't seem to be valid anymore at this point of time. It may be different again next year. I recently walked into a library in Merrickville, which is a brand new library, very beautiful, by a local architecture firm, and was full of students kind of in groups or individually studying and learning and browsing the internet and so on. And I spoke to the librarian, and she said, none of these students has ever looked at a single one of our books. So it's a library, right, full of books, but they don't go there to read books. They go there to see other people, to be outside of their homes and to have access to internet and to be able to study. And in different configurations, you know, alone, in two, in three, in four, in five, or in bigger groups. And so the office of the future is certainly much more of this sort of space rather than sitting, you know, in a row, typing numbers into Excel spreadsheets. And I think you guys with the virtual backgrounds, Max is probably on the beach and you are, I don't know where you are, you know, you could be anywhere. And so it's kind of, it's interesting how, we are in the same space now, in the same virtual space, but we're in three completely different environments. I don't know if that answers your question, but it was a very difficult question.
It definitely did to me. And I actually have kind of a related question for you, Chris. Some kind of critics of modern architecture and some of these types of designs argue that they're beautiful to look at. It might be energy efficient or whatever the case may be, but they're not very kind of human centric or human friendly. And especially when it comes to this kind of parametric design where you're algorithmically weighting aspects of it. Sometimes in the design process, maybe you can almost get lost that these buildings are designed for people, right? So how do you ensure when you guys are working on a project, and especially these bigger complex projects like you were referring to earlier, that the design isn't simply just beautiful or aesthetic for beauty's sake, but that it's also a place that fits the human-centric purpose of that place, like the library you were mentioning earlier?
Yeah. But there's certainly a trap that you can fall into, that you get carried away with the aesthetic or the excitement of formal languages that you can create. But the idea would certainly be that the parameters include, of course, how the end user is using a space like that and how they interact. So if you, for example, design a library and you model the user profile of the different people using the library and how they would behave within the library, and then you shape spaces according to the requirements of these people. And that's pretty much, I think, how this library that I visited, you know, the result of that is. So you have like multi-tiered spaces, you have terraces, you have little coves, little caves, you have open air spaces, balconies, you have group spaces, you have individual spaces, you have formal and informal spaces. And all of that creates like an ecosystem for people to work, read books, study, et cetera, et cetera. So I think you have to make that part of your parameters. And maybe the early generations of this parametric design concentrated too much on formal kind of shape making, which is certainly not the idea of it. There's nothing parametric about shape making. Parameters, the parameters, so that's maybe another important distinction to make. A building is, no matter how parametric it is only as smart as the input that you put in. So if your parameters are not smart, then the building is not smart either. So the parameters have all to be about social aspects as well as technological aspects, cost aspects, functional aspects. And when you think about a building like the pyramids, I don't know if I mentioned that before, made from bricks. So the pyramids can only be as smart as the brick that they're built from. The bricks in that case are giant kind of sandstone blocks. And we're thinking that the individual components of a building, they should start being smart components. So then you start building your pyramids based on smart components. So the overall building becomes a smart building as well, rather than starting with a kind of dumb material and kind of hoping that the final thing will be smarter than what you put in. So it's all about the input. And the input is the input of the people involved, the technology involved, the material involved, and the thinking behind it. It's also about the goals, isn't it? Like, what are the aims of your development? Are the aims that you buy another Ferrari, or are the aims that you create amazing spaces for people to live?
That's amazing. And I love that you define people in a space so that people can live there. That's a thing that can be like a casual, but it's so important when you have that in mind to design. And talking about that, let's talk about city of the future. Do you think that how the city of the future looks like?
Yeah, well, the city of the future, nobody knows exactly what the city of the future looks like. In particular now, we don't know if the CBD as such is even relevant anymore. I mean, I've been thinking that actually for many years, even before 2020. You know, this whole idea when you look at Manhattan or the Sydney CBD or Chicago or this kind of grid, high-rise tower, and you know, curtain wall facade, and then you put all the bankers and all the insurance people and all the lawyers into these glass towers, and then you think that's the city. And then you put a food court at the bottom of the tower so they have something to eat, and then if they're lucky you put some sort of green space somewhere in walking distance, and that's the city of the future. You know, and now that all these buildings are empty and everybody's working remotely, you have to question if that was the right answer or not. So this whole idea of concentration of certain trades or professions in one location for the sake of it, I think is probably an outdated idea. The whole idea of a city like New York based on a grid was essentially a simplification. You know, a coral reef is not based on a grid, but if you do a city, you know, a surveyor comes 400 years ago, sets out a point and says, okay, we call these streets 1 to 50 and A to Z, and then it's easy to subdivide them and to allocate them to individual developers and then build up the city. But the way that we actually as a society work and think and have evolved is much more non-linear. So nobody thinks or works or lives in a grid, and life is not like that. So I think in the future, cities, I don't think cities will cease to exist, but cities will be much more nature-like, multi-level, multi-dimensional, multi-geometrical networks, and it will become much more important how the city works in terms of energy, in terms of transportation, in terms of communication flow, in terms of three-dimensional arrangement of spaces, of resources, etc. So certainly the city of the future is not a square grid of rectangular curtain wall buildings with a food court at the bottom and kind of a train station in walking distance. The city of the future has to be more a living environment for people who actually enjoy being in that environment. And that can be vertical, can be horizontal, but more likely it will be a multi-layered development.
That makes sense. And I kind of agree with your future prognosis there with a caveat, which brings me to my next question. These kind of multi-layered and organic designs like that are often fantastic in both a theoretical sense and even transferring to practicality, except when they run into the wall of urban planning and city planning. So I'd love to hear a little bit from you about how you guys kind of have to conform your designs around the constraints of city planning, which can often, frankly, reduce the kind of the livability and the positive impacts of a design. And then relatedly, what you see happening to cities like San Francisco and New York, or San Francisco being my favorite example, where it's almost illegal to build anything now because of the so many veto points, and it's so difficult to get a project past local boards and everything. So first, how do you guys kind of work around those issues? And then what do you see happening to the cities who are, frankly, for lack of a better term, stuck, like San Francisco and New York?
And Sydney. No, I think, it's a very good question. And obviously, if we're talking kind of about kind of general ideas, it's one thing. But the reality, if you're in any of these cities and there's a site, the site has very stringent controls, setbacks, height controls, plot ratios. There's like 1,000 pages of building code relating to every single aspect of the building. And on top of that, you have the financial kind of feasibility of a developer. You have a space program, which of course maximizes the building envelope. Because if you can build 43 levels, you will build 43 levels and not 42. You know, if you can build 453 apartments, you will try to build 455 apartments and not less. And that is just the nature of development. And that results in the kind of architecture that we see. And very rarely that is challenged, and very rarely you can come up with alternatives to that. Essentially, the only way to get around these ideas is where you have, for example, 10 sites and you say, listen, instead of complying exactly on each of these 10 sites and building the same generic chicken box on each of the sites, why don't we look at the whole site as one development, maybe concentrate the building mass in one area and build a park in the other area. you know, where you can kind of offset these things. And I think that's also where the opportunities in places like New York are, where you have transfer of air rights. And I think the High Line is a good example where all of a sudden interesting architecture could emerge out of this unique situation of a former goods line transformed into a public park and so on. So quite often the bureaucratic process behind these cities makes it very difficult. How do you come up against that? Is probably, looking at it from a greater perspective. So don't look at it on each individual plot, but looking at greater strategies of how you can, you know, comply on one side and create something else on the other side to counterbalance. And I think the idea is always to create greater strategies. I mean, one example, we won a competition for a stadium in Addis Abeba in Ethiopia. And the competition asked for a soccer stadium, 50,000 seats. And that's it. They didn't ask for anything else. So we gave them a stadium, 50,000 seats, but then we designed a whole sports city around the stadium because we said the stadium is not like an individual object sitting on an empty field. The stadium is a major attractor for the people. It's an opportunity for sports, for education, for hospitality, etc. So we had a sports hotel, a sports hospital, training grounds, swimming centers, you know, sports education, etc., and all of a sudden created like a whole precinct for sports. And that was the competition winning idea and not what the actual stadium looks like. So if you try and think beyond the brief, I guess, and try to have strategies that go beyond what you're actually asked to design. But again, that is easier said than done. If your brief is to build a house on a 100 square meter site in a heritage area of San Francisco, then it's a little bit more difficult.
Chris, I would like to talk about Honduras. Honduras is, well, you have been in Honduras. I would love your opinion about Honduras, and I would love your opinion about Lava Honduras.
Honduras. Honduras is beautiful, and it's, you know, if I tell people I went to Honduras, most people don't know where Honduras is. And then they Google Honduras, and the first page that comes up is like, Honduras is the crime capital of the world. Then the second page is, Honduras is the drug capital of the world. And the third page is, you're more likely to get murdered than to have a holiday in Honduras. And then when you get like to the 10th page of Google, then you start discovering that it's actually a beautiful country with a beautiful culture and history. A beautiful people, beautiful landscape, and incredible kind of opportunities. So sometimes you have to look past the first 10 pages of Google results. And I was invited, this is now 2 years ago, isn't it, Max? To San Pedro Sula, to a conference at the university there, SAP it's called. And that was an opportunity, you know, when I get invited to things like that, obviously it's an effort for me to go all the way to Honduras, but it was an opportunity for me to broaden my horizon, to make some new friends, to just explore new grounds. And I found this beautiful country full of super excited people, you know, and it feels like it's on the cusp of something. It's on the cusp. It's people who maybe haven't had the same opportunities as other people to travel, to have access to architecture around the world, you know. And a European architecture student, he would have been to at least like average, you know, 15 countries, would have traveled to all Corbusier buildings, I don't know, Rancolas buildings, Renzo Piano buildings, would have been to Venice, would have been to Reykjavik. And when you're in Honduras, you probably haven't traveled to all those places, but maybe you've traveled, you know, to the Maya temples and to the Copan ruinas and those kind of things. But what I found that the people are extremely curious and extremely thankful to receive, you know, input from outside. And so I gave a series of workshops in Honduras, which we kind of themed around this idea of ecosystems and architecture. So we studied coral reefs and mangrove forests and things like that, and translated that into the ideas of urbanism with very simple means. You know, people went like, oh, shall I bring my computer? I'm like, no, don't worry about it. You know, bring a pen and a piece of paper. And we did this workshop over 2 days, literally sketching ideas on flip charts and collaging them together. And it was amazing how the students were excited. And within 2 days, kind of from being a student sitting there soaking up information to kind of sharing information with their peers and becoming almost teachers and, you know, ambassadors for their own ecosystems in their country. So that was kind of my introduction to Honduras. And then I was very lucky to be introduced to an interesting group of like-minded people who are developing on the beautiful island of Roatán on a development called Prospera Land. And I think we get to that a little bit later. But that kind of brought this idea of setting up a little lava studio in Honduras. And with this idea that I spoke about earlier, that lava is more of a network rather than, you know, a hierarchical kind of organization, we thought, why not have a little outpost in Honduras and see how that can grow, you know? And yeah, I see huge potential. It doesn't have to be the biggest architecture firm of all times in Honduras, but I think we can make a meaningful difference there to the life of people and to the future of Honduras. And that's what we're trying to do at the moment. It's very exciting to work with the local team there.
I love it, Chris. And speaking of that, actually, I want to dive into kind of your work with Prospera a little bit. Could you tell us kind of in an open-ended way, you could take this however you like, but can you tell us a little bit about some of the work you're doing with us here at Prospera and kind of the vision for that?
Well, I guess the vision is to, so Roatán Island is this beautiful tropical island, which has a rich history of colonial settlement, of pirates, of treasures, of cruise ships, and all sorts of different forms of tourism and local industry, fishing industry, etc. And I think the idea is to develop Roatán in an alternative manner to traditional tourist destinations, where usually a tourist destination is run by an offshore kind of operator to cater for offshore visitors who come, spend a couple of days there, and leave, but leave nothing behind other than their waste. So they don't engage with the culture, they don't engage with the local traditions or the local people. And usually the local people don't benefit from that form of tourism. And so the idea is in Roatán to build up communities based on tourism, but also based on business opportunities. And essentially creating a platform for people from around the world to invest in a safe and stable and independent environment in Roatán to create like a new society on the island. And the whole idea of the CEDES, of these independent free zones, which is an idea that has been taken up in various parts around the world, is to create kind of an independent environment of safe investment and prosperity for everybody and not only individuals that own the place. And so architecturally, that's interesting for us because it's not just a mono kind of architectural solution for villas or townhouses or hotel rooms, but it's actually a mix of different typologies that create a community on this island. So from low rise to high rise, laboratories, hospitals, apartments, workplaces, and at the same time, working opportunities, employment opportunities, education opportunities, and growth opportunities for the local population.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
I'm sure you could.
So working with Prosper, as you said, we're focused on creating jobs and creating prosperity for Hondurans and bringing kind of the best of the world and the best of Honduras together. And one of the ways we've done that is by making an institutional environment that makes it a heck of a lot easier to build things and to create things. Can you tell us a little bit about how Prospera's more open planning and design process and the kind of the severable and tradable rights concept that we have that enables creating more or less anything within a given safety and size envelope? How has that influenced the work Lava has been doing for Prospera, and what has that enabled you to do that you might not have been able to do elsewhere where, as you said, you're normally constrained by these setbacks and specific design aspects?
Well, I guess being at ZEDE, an economic free zone, which creates its own building regulation and its own kind of plot ratio, height limits, density, et cetera, creates an opportunity that the rules are created as we go rather than from the outset. So the rules are flexible, and similar to this analogy of a coral reef which grows according to certain parameters, but according to demand, according to sunlight, according to nutrients and inhabitants, a place like Prospera can grow according to the uptake in the marketplace. And it can change over time, and it can change direction over time as well. So I think we are creating together with the client and the different advisors, kind of we are seeding essentially a city rather than completing a city. So the city will be grown and it will move into the directions that we will jointly take it into. And I think most importantly, we need to start, and we are in the process of starting, and then the process will become much more dynamic and take up its own kind of dynamics.
Awesome. I love it. I got to say, one of the things that made me the most excited about working with Prospera was this built environment aspect, because it holds so many other great cities back. So the kind of policy environment we've created around architecture and building things in the physical world is one of the things that I think is going to enable Prospera to create prosperity in a way much more rapidly than pretty much anywhere else in the world, if I do say so myself. So Chris, related to this concept of both what you're building with Prospera and more generally, I have a funny backstory for you, Chris. I first kind of discovered your work and heard about you through Reddit, actually. I browse this subreddit called Imaginary Cityscapes occasionally, and I stumbled across this one time that looked like this futuristic Hanging Gardens of Babylon almost. So I did a reverse Google image search to see where this came from, because they didn't attribute you or Lava. And I discovered your firm to that. It was this, this Shenzhen Jungle Plaza, my background right now. That's how I kind of discovered your work. But it brought a question to mind, both with regard to this design and then more broadly, including your work with Prospera, which is how do you integrate nature in the way that you do both here with the Shenzhen Jungle Plaza, the way we're planning to do with Prospera and in your other designs, without like doubling or tripling the kind of the water requirements and the energy requirements? Because I could see there being an interplay there, especially as when it comes to water requirements for this greenery that could have a negative impact on sustainability. So how do you kind of manage that in the design process?
I mean, the Shenzhen Jungle Plaza is an interesting project. And maybe similar to the Ethiopia Stadium, we were given a program which was a very generic program. You know, you have like two shopping malls, a hotel, three residential towers, and an office kind of development. That's a space program. And so everybody else would have just organized that in a series of square boxes, and you're done. And we said, this site in Shenzhen, which is kind of south of China, a very tropical climate and known for its canals and waterways and existing canals and waterways on the site. So we organized the master plan in a way that it becomes a destination, and it kind of reinterprets the existing waterways as this kind of waterscape, terraced hillscape, which is completely different from any other kind of shopping or residential or hotel or office development. So instead of taking a green field and turning that into a concrete slab, you take the green field and turn it into a vertically terraced, even more green field. And so, of course, in terms of water management, in terms of plants and so on, that requires certain technologies and certain care of how to do that. But we think as a model for any development around the world, if you take away green space from the planet, you have to replace it within your buildings. And that's the idea. The waterways in this case, they're water canals that are existing that we are rerouting and kind of routing throughout the buildings and becoming part of the building water cycle. It depends. If you try to do the same thing in a desert environment where water is extremely scarce, then you would have to work a lot harder to provide water and greenery. But in an environment like Shenzhen and also Roatan, which is very lush and green and tropical, I think that's much more easy to do.
Okay, Chris, I usually close on the same question for everyone because I love picking the brains of people such as yourself that think about the world a little differently. And I will admit I took this question from Tim Ferriss's podcast because I think he gets great answers from it. So Chris, if you could put anything, whether it be text, images, could be a single word, whatever you please, on every single billboard around the world for a day to convey a message to the world for a day, what would you put on the billboard?
Wow. Thanks for putting me on the spot.
Take your time.
A single message. So I'm not going to put like world peace and love and all that sort of stuff, which goes for itself. But I mean, relative to what we are doing, I would put something around visionary architecture, and I would probably say today we need to do the impossible.
I absolutely love
that. Think about that a little bit.
I love it.
Everybody wakes up and thinks about what can I do today that I thought is impossible, but can it actually be done?
Totally,
I think that's
agree.
The kind of spirit that we have to have in any field, you know, like, because if we don't think that way, then there's no point in getting up in the morning.
I couldn't agree more. I absolutely love it. And with that, we will call it a day. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. And this has been the Epicenter Podcast.
Thank you so much. And looking forward to see you guys soon again.
Absolutely.